This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, Jake Harper from SideFX Public Media checks in to share some reporting he's done on the Indiana Women's Prison and their problems with employee turnover. He'll share what some former employees think are among the issues contributing to it. And Brock Turner from WFIU Bloomington unpacks a story he did on caregiver visitation protocols at long-term care facilities, why some residents at nursing homes haven't seen their caregivers since the onset of the pandemic, and why some of those safety protocols may be too strict given what we know about the coronavirus. And later, a new art exhibition in Columbus displays public art proposals designed for Southern Indiana. We'll hear from the curator and two of the artists. But first, we'd like to start with an Indiana news recap from the past week with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. We had, though, a big spike in cases, I guess, recently. What do we know from the numbers?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 3,534 people have been confirmed to have died from COVID-19. There are more than 131,000 confirmed cases, and more than 1.4 million Hoosiers have been tested. So to put that into context, in the last week, 105 people have died from COVID-19, and we've had nearly 9,000 new cases. Today, the state reported 1,832 new cases, shattering previous records since the start of the pandemic. Nearly 1,200 Hoosiers are hospitalized with COVID-19, which is the most since May 22nd. To kind of add on to that context, 9 of the last 14 days, we've had more than 1,000 cases reported, and we've broken the records for single-day confirmed cases 3 times since October 1st. We have to go back to June 20th for a higher single-week death count, and the percentage of ICU beds available statewide is at its lowest at 30.3% since the state started reporting that number in early April.
Oh, my goodness. So the numbers that were reported today are the highest yet. Is that right?
By a whole 23% if Eric Berman from WIBC's numbers are correct.
Is there any kind of anomaly that we can attribute that to? Are there more tests being done? What do we know there?
No, not really. The tests are fairly consistent with the number that we're having administered. We have seen quite a substantial increase in the number of tests, over the last few weeks. But that's not something that could really explain nearly 2,000 new cases today.
There's some accusation that numbers are being made up.
Yeah, there's I love Twitter and I hate it so much sometimes.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
Yeah. There are a handful of folks that I've seen on Twitter who have claimed that the air quotes media are either making up these numbers or blowing them entirely out of proportion, which is also one of the reasons why I have all the contextual data that I had today. And doing so this close to the election, because we're doing it to either support President Trump's re-election campaign or that we are trying to hurt it. I'm confused.
I guess if we're being accused of both, then we're doing something right.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And all that people need to do, right, is go to coronavirus.in.gov and see the state's numbers right there. It's not the media's numbers. It is the state's numbers, as I understand it.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I do also want to address, there are a lot of folks who are like, well, you're just using these numbers to scare us. And I mean, frankly, I'm a little worried, like seeing these kinds of numbers. Again, it's hard to compare the numbers that we have right now to what we had in April, right? In April, we weren't testing everyone. We weren't, if you did not have symptoms, you were not being tested. And even now, if you don't have symptoms, it's still a little bit harder for you to get tested than if you are symptomatic. So it's hard to compare like these 2 points in time. But this is a wave, and this is a surge in new cases, and this is an opportunity to take mask suggestions from the government, from the governor, more seriously to make sure that you are really buckling down and doing all of the things that healthcare professionals have asked, doing social distancing, being really stringent about hand washing and everything like that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, this is us trying to make this better. As a journalist, I live in these communities. I live in Indianapolis. I have for the vast majority of my life. My parents and grandparents live in central Indiana. And so it is in my best interest and in everyone's best interest if, you know, we take these numbers very seriously.
It's all about being informed, and all we're trying to do is put the information out there. And with all of that said, what is we visited this a little bit last week. What has the governor said about potentially rolling back restrictions, going back to maybe phase four and a half, three?
The governor's ongoing position is that it is the responsibility of all Hoosiers to help mitigate the virus's spread. This is also the first week that he did not do a press conference. And instead, we heard from Dr. Chris Box, the state health commissioner, talking about the latest COVID-19 numbers, which she also characterized as concerning. But Box said much of the state is still in a low-risk position. And so she said the state is focused on talking with local governments and health departments where the spread of the virus is getting worse. The other thing to keep in mind, if you are going to coronavirus.in.gov, is that, you know, that big, beautiful map that I gushed about not even 3 weeks ago is also delayed by a week. So the numbers that we're seeing now, these crazy numbers that we're seeing now, will not be reflected in that map for another week. So keep in mind also, as you're using that as a guide, that the data is delayed. Governor Eric Holcomb, however, said the state is in a, quote, much different place than it was at the start of the pandemic, and just really emphasized the need for people to be responsible. The other thing to keep in mind is Saturday, October 17th, is the expiration of the mask mandate. So the next week will also be interesting to see if we hear from the governor about extending that, or the mask order, not a mask mandate. It is not a mandate. But yeah.
All right. And if we look then at this story that kind of emerged last week and then reemerged this week about the mail-in deadline ruling. So last week we found, well, I'll let you take it from here because it is a little dizzying.
It's a little confusing, and it doesn't help that there's two different vote-by-mail lawsuits that are currently going through federal courts right now. So this particular lawsuit is about the deadline. I think it's Common Cause Indiana and the NAACP charged that the deadline for mail-in ballots to get in before noon on Election Day was unconstitutional. And a federal judge said last week that, yes, totally agree, especially considering that overseas ballots have 10 days after the election to be received, that should all mail-in ballots should be counted in the same way. However, on Tuesday, she temporarily halted her own ruling, which would have forced Indiana to count mail-in ballots that are postmarked by Election Day. She said basically she halted her ruling for 7 days specifically to give the appeals court time to consider the case. And so she's urged voters to get their ballots in well ahead of time and had some concerns about making this change, you know, less than 4 weeks ahead of the November election.
So it seems like it may have been that the halting of that ruling may have been made out of an abundance of caution so that she could possibly get a second judicial opinion, perhaps.
Yes.
All right. And what else do we have on vote by mail? Another expansion has been denied, or is this a continuation? What's going on?
So the expansion would have. So this particular federal case was to expand vote by mail to more Hoosiers, right? So Indiana, you have to have one of 11 excuses in order to apply for a mail-in ballot. Indiana is one of only four states in the entire country that is sticking by this in light of the coronavirus. Tuesday, that was denied. A federal appeals court ruled on Tuesday that basically it's the pandemic, not the state, that's to blame if Hoosiers choose not to cast a ballot this year because of fears around COVID-19. The court's decision said Indiana had no constitutional duty to expand vote by mail. This particular lawsuit was put together by a group of Indiana residents that sued the state, trying to force it to allow registered voters to cast mail-in ballots for the 2020 election. The same way that we did in the primary. But Republicans, not only on the Indiana Elections Commission, but also the Secretary of State and Governor, have refused to do so for the fall.
Okay. And how many Hoosiers have been counted in the 2020 census?
More than 99.9%, which is
okay.
Dope. More than 99% of homes across the country have been counted for the 2020 census. Specifically in Indiana, 99.9% of residents have filled out the census. 70% of those who actually responded online by phone or by mail. And then the other 29% after the census workers were able to follow up with them. And so this is, I mean, the census is incredibly important because of the amount of money that state and county and even local governments get because of population data.
Okay. And let's take a look at the Indiana 2022 way, or rather give it another mention because we can't mention it enough. What are we covering?
We're talking about just so much, especially leading up to the November election. We're focusing on issues outside of coronavirus, including doing weekly short explainer videos on questions we received. So,
and they're so good. I've got to say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but they're so good. And I know you do them, right?
I've done two of them.
You got a hand
two
on it.
More that I'm going to show my mug on for reasons beyond my comprehension or understanding.
Great work. So Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. She knows what's up. She knows how to break it down. She makes all our web stories look as good as they could possibly be. Lauren, thanks.
Text elections to 73224.
Hey, there you go. 73224. Text elections to 73224. Up next, a close look at problems with employee turnover at the Indiana Women's Prison. Do their issues reflect the broader prison system? Plus, why caregiver visitation protocols may be too strict or too confusing at Indiana's long-term care facilities. I'm Matt Pelser. That's up in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. COVID has really complicated things in the prison system. And at the Indiana Women's Prison, those who aren't forced to be there, i.e. the staff, are leaving at an alarming rate for reasons directly and indirectly connected to the pandemic. But those who've already quit say the turnover problem has a lot to do with how the prison is run, and the pandemic just made things worse. Joining me now is Jake Harper, who's been reporting on this with Side Effects Public Media. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Matt.
So you've been doing a lot of reporting on the Indiana Women's Prison since the pandemic started. What made you want to focus on them?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons for that. One is just that the work sort of snowballs. I did some stories on the women's prison, and then I got more people reaching out to me regarding that prison. And the Indiana Women's Prison is also closest to home. It's in Indianapolis, so it seems worth it to focus on it. But also the Indiana Women's Prison can serve as sort of an example. It's not necessarily unique. Prisons are run by the state. So some of the issues that are happening in the women's prison are happening elsewhere. But I am still reporting on other prisons. It's just in some cases, it's more slow going.
And of course, we're focusing on turnover at the Indiana Women's Prison specifically right now. But I mean, is turnover, does it seem to be an issue throughout the prison system at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. The Indiana Women's Prison is actually among the better ones when you look at how many people have left month over month. Across the board, the latest vacancy rate that we've got is 18.5% in the state's adult prisons. So that's 1,200 jobs that are unfilled right now across the state. One prison, the Miami Correctional Facility, has a 32% vacancy rate. And when you talk to people who work at these places, they're severely understaffed, which creates safety concerns. So if you don't have enough staff, you can't keep things running smoothly or safely. The state has brought in the National Guard to help out at some facilities, but it still seems that understaffing is a major issue.
I mean, and when we look specifically at Indiana Women's Prison, who you say are among the better prisons as far as turnover is concerned and vacancies, I mean, are there additional reasons there that, turnover has been high?
Yeah, I mean, turnover, I should say turnover in corrections is a national problem. Indiana's not unique. But reading some reports from the National Institute of Correction, you know, the people I've spoken to really sort of illustrate these widespread concerns. The main reasons people leave is that corrections doesn't pay that well, and it's a really stressful job. So stressed officers leave, which further strains the facility, which causes more stress. And then that can lead to mental and physical health problems for officers. A lot of officers will start taking sick days just because they don't want to go to work. And so it can spiral out of control.
Did any of the turnover have much to do with concern over catching COVID? I mean, was that a factor at all?
So I spoke with the ombudsman for the Department of Corrections, who's responsible for fielding complaints. She's put in reports before that turnover is one of the biggest issues for IDOC. And she told me that people were retiring because of COVID. So there may be truth to that. Talking with officers, that didn't seem to be a major factor. Only one of them volunteered that she was worried about it, and she sort of lumped it in with all these other concerns. And it may be that my sample didn't really catch enough of those people who were primarily worried about COVID. But it does seem that COVID sort of accelerated these staffing issues. So during the pandemic, at the women's prison in particular, women were being locked in their cells for most of the day. These cells don't have toilets or running water. They're really hot, especially in the summer. And so women were passing out. They were peeing in cups. And that type of situation sort of weighs on the people working in the prison. And some of the officers disagreed with how things were being run and caused them to leave.
And you did talk to some specific corrections officers, guards, and you wrote about one who was told to meet a quota for inmate write-ups and that it was hard to find that many violations to meet that quota. Why was that? And what ended up happening with that officer?
Yeah, so in general, what I heard from the former officers that I spoke with was that some of them felt pressured to treat women inside more harshly than necessary or more harshly than their training called for. One of an officer's responsibilities is to make sure everyone behaves in the prison and to correct behavior when they see things that are out of line. If necessary, they can write an offender up, which has punishments attached to it, ranging from time in solitary confinement to maybe a few days without commissary or being able to make phone calls. One officer who asked to use her middle name in the story, Renee, she in particular was labeled offender friendly by superior officers, which was a term I heard a lot. And she was told that she had to meet a quota. She had to write up 3 inmates a day. And sometimes she just didn't see that many things that were going wrong. Maybe an offender was wearing their mask incorrectly. And, you know, instead of writing them up, she chose to say, hey, pull your mask up, because she felt that that's what her training actually called for. Her bosses wanted to discipline her for not meeting her quota. And eventually she just was fed up and walked out.
How is the staff expected to treat the inmates? I mean, obviously, it's a prison. It's not supposed to be a good time, but did it seem to go far beyond that there at the women's prison from the people you talked to?
It did. I mean, I haven't been through their training, but they felt that the pressure was on to sort of treat women more harshly than they were supposed to. The main character in my web story was named Amanda Kohlhepp. She was actually a correctional sergeant. She had actually been promoted for being good at her job at a different prison before she got to the women's prison. And she told me she responded to an incident once where someone was passed out having what she described as a heat stroke, but the officer on duty hadn't called for the medical staff to come over yet. She actually had to do that when she arrived, even though it was very clearly a medical emergency. She also said she was involved in an incident where she felt pressured to try to subdue a woman. The woman flailed and kicked her kind of accidentally. And even though Amanda wasn't injured, the woman who kicked her got months in solitary confinement for it.
And that same officer, Amanda, that you talked to was later fired for trafficking, which sounds serious and is indeed a criminal offense. What did she traffic?
So trafficking is sort of a term that's used to describe a staff member giving something called an article to an inmate. And an article can really be anything from a piece of clothing to soap to a pen. In this case, what happened, Amanda was working on a unit that had an issue in a cell where feces had been rubbed all over a wall, and the responsibility of cleaning that wall fell to one of the inmates. Amanda that day sort of took, I think she took pity on the inmate cleaning it and offered her a cup of coffee. She didn't bring the coffee into the prison for her. She had made a pot and decided to offer the woman a cup. Another woman who was on that unit was in her cell and asked Amanda for a popsicle, and Amanda gave her one. She kind of assumed that the woman had already gotten one because she knew to ask for it. So she gave her one, and those two incidents were caught on camera and used as sort of ammunition to fire her.
But if a CO, a corrections officer, gets caught trafficking, I mean, is that an automatic termination?
It's not. So I reached out to the Department of Correction about this, and they did say that it's not every case that warrants a firing. In this case, Amanda felt that she sort of had a target on her back because of the way she treated inmates, and she had had some disagreements with her superiors. And so she felt that this was sort of an excuse to fire her, which is what eventually happened.
And you actually heard from a Department of Corrections spokesperson as you were putting this together. What did he think you should mention in your piece?
Yeah, so I reached out and said, you know, I'm doing a story about turnover. There were multiple emails where I asked for specifics about Amanda Kohlhepp's firing and things like that. I didn't get any specifics apart from the charges that were leveled against her, primarily trafficking. But he did point out that, you know, the Department of Correction has had numerous hiring events this year. They make efforts to show appreciation for their staff through giving of sort of coins or awards to show that they appreciate what the staff does. And he also mentioned that the article could serve as sort of a recruitment tool to show that there are career opportunities in the Department of Correction. All of those things made, I read them to Amanda, and all of those things made Amanda laugh, just because she said, you know, I got a pin 1 year as a bonus. So that's how much they appreciate me. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, she thought that was a little bit ridiculous. And I should say, I reach out with every story that I'm doing to the Department of Correction to get their response and to try to get an interview with someone to really dive into some of these issues and find out more information about what's happened or more information about Department of Correction policies. And I, in the 6 months plus that I've been reporting on prisons, I've only gotten one interview back in May. The rest has been sort of emailed statements like this.
And indeed, we look forward to more reporting. Jake Harper is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, and he's been talking to us about turnover at the Indiana Women's Prison. Jake, thanks.
Yeah, you bet.
And now a look at how the pandemic is making some long-term care facilities in Indiana seem like prisons. WFIU's rural affairs reporter Brock Turner joins us now. Hi, Brock.
How's it going, Matt?
Not bad, but let's look at the beginning of the pandemic when it comes to long-term care facilities. So nursing homes and these facilities started closing off to the outside world. Why?
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't really have any idea what this was going to look like. We didn't know how the virus spread. We didn't have testing. We didn't know about the effectiveness of mask wearing. I mean, I remember when CDC and prominent health organizations said, don't wear masks because they're not going to do any good. But then as we started learning more about the pandemic, more about how COVID-19 affected folks and the coronavirus spread, we started to figure out that, you know, maybe it is better if we close these facilities. So initially, it was a pure safety standpoint because we just didn't know. But then as we started to learn more about the virus, it became clearer and clearer that that this arrangement that we had probably wasn't going to work long term. At least that's what caregivers say.
Well, and so we know a little bit more now. Everyone has a mask. Testing is better. PPE is better. Have the protocols in long term care facilities changed to reflect that?
They've changed slightly, but not significantly. And I think that's the biggest issue that caregivers have with these policies is that they can't get in to see their loved ones. For many of them, it's been 6-8 months since they've seen their loved ones. And these are populations who oftentimes are so used to seeing family members. And maybe even if they haven't seen family members, it honestly gets worse because a lot of them haven't seen fellow residents that they're with because they have been so isolated in those facilities. So no, the protocols for visitation haven't really changed. We've seen some outdoor visitation. There are some programs for indoor visitation, but not significantly so.
Caregivers often do just that, give care in a very real way. They help with cooking, cleaning, bathing. If they're not allowed in, what does that mean?
Well, so many caregivers that I've spoken with say that they desperately want to do this work, and they just want to take care of their loved ones. And it's really difficult to do that through a window visit or virtually. And when you begin to think about what they do, it's beyond just the basic physical needs. I mean, some of those are met at the facilities, at the nursing homes, but a lot of it also comes down to just the mental aspect of this, Matt. I mean, I think about, you know, individuals who are isolated, and it does make such a difference when you have someone that you know and that cares about you to have that visitation and that, you know, face-to-face contact. I think that's so important and often really gets lost when we're talking about these policy debates and figuring out, you know, what's the best public health practice. I think so often, you know, caregivers feel like they just care about the mental aspect of this as well.
How is the state working with facilities when it comes to allowing caregiver visitation?
So the state has really two things that they're doing. The first is they provide guidance in memo format to facilities, and that sort of serves as a framework for long-term care facilities to guide them. But the biggest key word there is guidance, Matt. It's not written in and mandated anywhere. So a facility, you know, while a lot of them follow this guidance, not all of them do. The other thing that the state has done is they've formed a program called the Essential Caregiver Program. That program, more or less, in theory, can give guidance and put additional folks in facilities. But in practice, that hasn't really happened because, again, as I said earlier, it's guidance, and it's not a mandated anywhere. And there's no real oversight that the state has to come back on facilities if they're not granting this caregiver status. I talked to one caregiver, who said that her application was denied and she visited her loved one every single day before this pandemic. And the facility really didn't have a valid reason to deny it. So it's very arbitrary. It's a patchwork. And sort of the state guidance has been sort of, in a lot of people's opinion, lacking because it hasn't provided a framework for visitation. And there's really no indication of what's going to happen as the weather continues to get colder.
Have the facilities you reported on been actively communicating these visitation policies to caregivers?
In a lot of cases, no. And that's another issue that sort of layers on top of the systemic problems that we have with this, because the policies do change frequently. I don't want to say that they don't. But it's also very difficult for family members because they could show up to the facility one day and an individual that's managing visitation might not be aware of the policy, and then they're told you can't see your loved one, or you can only have a window visit, or, you know, we don't have time for that today. So in a lot of cases, there's not firm guidance, and even if there is, a lot of times the facility staff that are actually, you know, carrying out that guidance, maybe they're not aware of it. So it's very much a patchwork across the state. And, you know, I think part of this is to be expected, right? Like I think a lot of people are understanding that there are going to be bumps in the road, but I mean, we are 6 months into this and there's really little end in sight. So I think it's difficult to continue to deal with the same issues that we've been dealing with for 6 months.
But I understand why long-term care facilities are being very careful, though. I mean, they house a particularly vulnerable population oftentimes. But is there any evidence, though, that visitation from caregivers and others have caused outbreaks?
According to the Indiana State Department of Health, no. During last week's press conference, they said as much. This is Dr. Lindsay Weaver.
We work very closely with the long-term care associations. We have biweekly phone calls with the long-term care facilities, work with them to really work through what does visitation look like? How can we do it safely? And when our surveyors go out, when our infection preventionists go out, they are seeing whether or not they're doing visitation. And of course, we always take family complaints or concerns, and we'll follow up on those. So thankfully, we have not really seen spread from visitation.
So clearly, as Dr. Weaver has said, outbreaks are not necessarily coming from visitation. And I think that continues to, reinforce this to caregivers that they don't understand why more liberal visitation policies haven't been implemented.
So these strict protocols, I mean, they might be protecting the residents' physical health, but do we have an idea of what it's doing to their mental health?
Yeah, it's really taking a toll. I mean, imagine anyone who is in a facility for a really long time. They can't see friends or family. Their only means of communication is via FaceTime. I mean, that's what a lot of us are dealing with. And I mean, there's even an argument that these measures aren't protecting residents' physical health as much, because a lot of those mental challenges are coming into and affecting their physical health. But even beyond that, you have people coming into facilities like delivery people, staff that's coming from different facilities. So the risk is not zero if you completely minimize visitation as well.
Brock Turner is the rural affairs reporter for our affiliate WFIU in Bloomington. Brock, thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Up next, a new art exhibition in Columbus displays several proposals for large public art installations with Southern Indiana in mind. We'll talk to the curator and a couple of the artists next. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. A new art exhibition in Columbus shows examples of public art with the landscape and architecture of Southern Indiana in mind. Paper Pavilions is on display now through November 21st at 411 Gallery in downtown Columbus. Joining me now is the Assistant Director for the Arts for the City of Bloomington and Curator of Paper Pavilions, Sean Starowitz. Good afternoon, Sean.
Afternoon, Matt. Thanks for having us.
Also with us are two of the artists featured in the exhibition from Richmond, Indiana, Joanne Quinones. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you.
And from Columbus, Rachel Cavate. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having us.
Sean, I'm sure you'll do a better job of explaining this exhibition than I just did. What's the idea behind Paper Pavilions?
Matt, actually, you did an incredible job. so I don't have too much to add on top of that. We should hire you as a hype person for the show.
Yeah, one line. One line's all I gave you.
Yeah. It's an exhibition that kind of explores new public art proposals. So it's a way of it's a different kind of exhibition than you're used to in terms of how we go to museums and see works of art. We usually see finished works. These are actual works in progress. So, some people were confused by the term maquette. A maquette is a model for a public sculpture, right? So it's a way to actually kind of have the Wizard of Oz moment of the curtain pulled back on the artistic process around how public art concepts and ideas can be developed over time. And this is really tied specifically to the artists involved, the connection to Southern Indiana, both through its natural landscape and also its built environment. You know, Columbus, Indiana is home to many mid-century modern monuments in a lot of ways. And so we really wanted to have an exhibition that explored new works around Southern Indiana. Yeah.
Is it common to display these maquettes of potential public art installations as an exhibit in and of itself? Or is this something that's, I guess, fairly uncommon?
It is fairly uncommon. Usually some larger cities, if they have a public art fund or a 1% fund, sometimes they might incorporate that into the process. A lot of times you just see the finished work. And so it becomes kind of this like UFO that lands in on a community. And then people are like, well, where'd that come from? Or the kind of critique of modernist sculpture in general, kind of just being plopped in on a community. And this was really, what we're doing in this show that's really different is that this set of artists were really tasked with investigating both the landscape and the built environment, and then the prompts of what we've been going through for the last 6 months in terms of sheltering at home, thinking about the future of our natural and built worlds, And then against the backdrop of a lot of the conversations around police brutality, state-sanctioned violence, and violence towards Black bodies in our communities across the United States.
Well, let's take a look, I guess, as much of a look as we can take over radio at a couple of the pieces that are being proposed. Joanne, you have two pieces in the exhibition. First, let's take a look at the one called From Around Here. Can you describe it?
Sure. From Around Here is a series of 16 portraits. I took photographs of people that are Hoosiers, have lived in Indiana for quite a while. And the title is the response to a pretty common question, I think, if you're a person of color, where are you from? Because the assumption is that you really can't be from around here. So every portrait has as the title the person's name and how many years they've actually lived in Indiana. In the portraits as well, there's stylized depictions of autumn olive and honeysuckle, and they're both invasive species in Indiana. And so there's a little bit of a juxtaposition to try to think about how do we decide who's native and who's not native, which bodies are welcome, and which ones maybe feel odd that they're present in the first place.
Did you have a place where you envisioned From Around Here being installed? Do you know where you would like it to go?
Actually, I'm probably like the artist that didn't follow the assignment because I really, truly don't want it to be installed anywhere. Even the second project. Is a proposal for something that I never want built. Because I think the biggest, the first sort of hurdle that we have to kind of go over in terms of how do we reimagine public space is the mental hurdle of how do we decide which bodies and how can certain bodies navigate a natural area. And I think that's the biggest thing that came out of this whole summer racial reckoning. I just really ended up taking away of Black, brown, queer people have to really figure out how to be good stewards of the earth in a way that's not in the regular format of possession and ownership. How do we belong? How do we become part of this landscape, especially in Indiana?
I'm curious what your second piece is, too.
The second piece is basically a proposal for building a wall right through the Touch the Earth natural area. So I'm hoping it's a little ridiculous. I don't want anyone to think that's a really good idea. but it's just a way to get people to question, you know, if you say I would never want to build a wall here because I have a commitment to preserve a natural area. Why doesn't that by extension relate to other areas where walls are being built? At what point are the sociopolitical factors more important than the environmental factors? And in what way are there also, I think, imaginary walls that stop people from thinking they really can fully participate in this act of preservation and enjoying nature?
Do you feel like your desire for this, for these two proposals not to be built, do you feel like that gave you this degree of artistic freedom to express exactly that?
Yeah, I think it did. Because when I was worried about this is actually going to be something that could be installed, I was too worried about how Sycamore Land Trust might respond to it, if they would want to fund it, you know. And basically, I just said, if I take that out of the equation, what is it that I really want to say? And basically, it's that it's so important for people of color and queer people to feel natural, to feel part of nature, to feel like they belong. And so if it meant I didn't have a proposal for something that could be built, so be it.
Rachel, what do you have in the Paper Pavilions exhibition?
So I also looked at the Touch the Earth site and looked at what could be proposed for sculpture in the space. And similar to Joanne, I really wanted to use this opportunity that Sean presented to think about how I could think outside of the box with my work a little bit, since it was a proposal for an idea and not necessarily going to be built. It was a great opportunity to really think more conceptually about my work instead of focusing on the actual construction of it. And so my concept really focuses on how we can start to think about sculpture as something that can change over time. A lot of times with architecture and with public sculpture, it's based very much with the understanding that we want it to last forever or as long as possible, and we want it to not change, and we construct it in a way that that we limit the amount of change over time. And I think, with the events of this year, as well as just, my personal feelings about public art is they should be a reflection of the times, and they should be allowed to change over time. So my piece really was a way to let nature take over the sculpture itself. I basically would build a stone carving, limestone, which is, from Southern Indiana, that could be on the site, and it would be constructed in a way that would actually accelerate changes from the natural environment through water, weather changes, through growth of plants, moss, lichens, even animals coming in, starting to move into the space, and how can we kind of accentuate that and make that change and the powers of nature taking over the artwork actually become the artwork itself.
So would you then be comfortable? Do you have an idea, I guess, of how they would change over time? Obviously, there's intent there with the design. You're the one who dreamt it up. But do you? I'll leave it at that, and then I'll follow up.
Sure. I do some stone carving and do some sculptures in public spaces, and I always have to think very carefully about how to make it last, make it durable. Which are important factors to consider. So this was an opportunity to kind of think in the opposite way. How can I design it so that it starts to change and break down? And that's really the point of it, is to show how the natural forces are at play and try to accentuate those. So, for example, with limestone, if you make areas where water can cool on the top, then you're actually promoting, freeze-thaw conditions that could eventually seep in and crack the limestone. You are promoting things like moss and lichen to develop. You're putting spaces where, seeds could fall in and get in crevices and cracks in the limestone and then start to grow, and the roots will start to break up the stone. So over time, it will, maybe change color with the moss and lichen growing on it. It, may start to crack and deteriorate, and that would be the actual art form.
So it sounds like you're anticipating any number of things that might happen, and you welcome every one of them.
Yeah, I think especially in our public spaces, it's often an idea of how do we control the space? Who's in control of the space? Who has power over this space? So the idea of, as an artist, of letting that go and saying, hey, this is the point of this, to let this control over this artwork go and let other forces, take control of it and be okay with that, is something I wanted to consider.
Sean, all of this work is from Midwestern artists, but most of them are Hoosiers. I'm curious, though, do you see any difference between the work that the Indiana artists brought versus those from outside the state?
No, I mean, I think all the artists in the show really leaned in on what it means to be Midwestern, and to, I think because we are, the age old term of flyover country, right? Mm. Trends don't necessarily fly here as always, right? We have a greater sense of looking out on the landscape, literally and figuratively, right? And so I think everybody in the show that was involved really took into some deep considerations and deep reflection and used this opportunity in terms of the imaginary and to kind of throw out the concerns of, oh, this is a taxpayer-funded public art piece. I have to consider this. I have to consider that. Or like, how do we actually build it? Gave an opportunity for a lot of the artists to, I think, ask deeper questions, both of themselves, their practice, but also of our communities, and to really kind of get at the deeper questions around our shared humanity and our shared built environment and our shared natural environments.
I would imagine, Sean, that getting a piece of public art installed is a big win for any artist. But these are proposals. Are there plans, I guess, for one or maybe a few of these proposals to maybe actually be installed somewhere sometime?
No, not at the moment. But I think that's the beauty of this show. And I think that is part of the poetic nature of the exhibition in and of itself, is that this can be maybe 3 or 4 years down the line revisited in a couple ways. Or I'm sure Joanne and Rachel can speak to this as well. These ideas might be revisited and recycled. Sometimes public art projects or art projects in general arrive ahead of time. Some, you know, the partnerships are there, the community's not ready, the artist isn't ready. So a lot of this really is in this moment and in this period of the great pause, so to speak, that we've been in with sheltering at home and coming out of that and asking a lot of tough questions as we even go, dare I say, into an election cycle and season. To ask these questions gives us an opportunity to think about another world being possible. And that's really what I hope individuals kind of take out of this. And it's not, I think we have to think about too, that art always isn't about the end product, but really the process involved. And that's what I really wanted. And these artists did such a good job in all the works, really kind of revealing that in their own process in terms of being ceramic or non-ceramic or pushing material, pushing experience a lot of different ways. So that has been a big highlight too.
So you have a number of partnerships that make this possible, including Sycamore Land Trust, and both of the artists with us today designed pieces with Touch the Earth Natural Area in mind. I'm curious, though, because things like nature preserves are meant to be kept natural, and some might see something like a public art installation as marring the natural landscape. How would you respond to a concern like that?
Yeah, I think there are ethical ways in which we can have temporary artistic interventions that are safe and community resilient. I think also just the partnership and the concept in and of itself is pretty radical in nature. Sycamore has not been approached in this manner before. So to potentially kind of create the field guide for a future public art installation at one of these sites is really powerful and really a unique opportunity that, I at the City of Bloomington would be really curious to pursue pending funding, right? And I'm sure Joanne and Rachel can speak to this too. As artists, I think we're always interested in shattering the kind of gallery model and shattering the kind of typical art experiences. And that's one thing we've kind of kept in mind. So to highlight and also to understand that the majority of South Central Indiana is state and forest preserves too. We are a very rural landscape focused state, and to highlight these natural areas and preserves and state forests and to forge these partnerships is really just an extension of a lot of important aspects of Hoosier identity in and of itself.
Paper Pavilions is an exhibition of public art proposals for Southern Indiana, and it's on display at the 411 Gallery in downtown Columbus, as well as online through November 21st. Sean Starowitz is its curator. Sean, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having us.
And thanks to the two artists who joined us. Joanne Quinones, thank you, Joanne.
Thank you.
Rachel Cavante, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, get it wherever you get podcasts. Monday, you'll hear from the candidates running for Attorney General in Indiana. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.